It's time for your weekly dose of Wayne's Comics.
I'm so glad you're listening to the 96th episode of the Wayne's Comics Podcast. I've got another great conversation with Mouse Guard's David Peterson. I've interviewed him a couple of times in the past, and he's always great fun to talk with. We get to discuss his latest miniseries, Legends of the Guard, Volume 2, Number 1, and we talk about some of his projects, including what he's going to be doing at conventions coming the rest of this year. And all that I'm sure you're going to want to listen to. Then Steve Davis joins me for news and previews, and we talk about a lot of interesting things that are going on in the comics industry. There's a lot to get to, so let's get on with the show.
Mice struggle to live safely and prosper among all of the world's harsh conditions and predators. The Mouse Guard, a selfless group of cloaked mice, keep the common mouse safe from predators, weather, and the wilderness. They patrol the mouse territories to allow mouse civilization not just to survive, but thrive. It matters not what you fight, but what you fight for.
I want to welcome back to the podcast David Peterson, creator of Mouse Guard, one of my very favorite comics out there. How are you doing today, David?
Good. Thanks for having me on.
Well, it's good to talk with you. There's a lot of good things going on. I just want to mention in passing that there's been news recently that Boom has acquired Arkeia, and we need the dust to settle a little more, I think, before we'll know more about that. But personally, I think that Mouse Guard has a good future ahead of it, and so I'm looking forward to that continuing. But we'll see.
Yeah.
So as far as Black Axe, the last time you and I talked, Black Axe number 5 had not come out yet.
Okay.
But I really love the final issue, and now I guess a hardcover is coming out shortly?
Yeah, hardcover is going to be out July 10th. So,
wow.
Really, really quick.
Not far away. Good. You'll have that for Baltimore then. That'll be great.
Yeah, I'll have that for Baltimore. I think we're going to be, in terms of conventions, it'll be debuting at San Diego. I mean, it'll be out in stores before then, but as far as a convention presence, I think San Diego is the first convention we'll have the Black Axe hardcover. It's a monster hardcover. It's thicker than any of the past Mouse Guard hardcovers because I did a lot more in the extras section.
Oh, like what kind of extras have you got?
Well, normally in the fall and winter, I have a two-page spread that's a map, and then a two-page spread, a couple two-page spreads that are locations or cutaways of locations, and then maybe an extra cutaway, or an extra two-page spread that's about common mouse trades or mouse life. So that makes four two-page spreads.
Cool.
For Black Axe, I think I have 11 two-page spreads, so 22 pages of just bonuses, and they're cutaways, they're slices of mouse life, they're multiple maps, they're listings of artifacts, and then an epilogue, and as always, we recollect all the content that's in the main Black Axe story, as well as all the pinups, all the great pinups that we collected during the issues.
Very cool. Do you know how much it's going to cost?
I believe it's the same cover price as the past volumes.
Oh, cool.
So wow. $24.95, I believe. But if that's not accurate...
Well, we'll find out.
I'm pretty sure that's correct, though.
Yeah, I would imagine. But, I guess Black Axe was, again, another one of those great stories. And when we get to the end, I'm always left going like, God, that was just a great story. The thing about your books that I always enjoy is that there's a beginning, a middle, and an end, and we actually get to a conclusion of some sort. And that's so unlike most of the rest of the comic out today.
I kind of patterned some of how I wanted to frame Mouse Guard on Mignola's path with Hellboy. Mm. At least the earlier part of Hellboy's run was a series of miniseries. And they didn't feel like ongoing comics, like a soap opera X-Men, where as soon as one thing is kind of resolving, you've already got the other thing not resolving because you've got to keep moving forward. You know, issue 123 is coming out in a month. Mm-hmm. I didn't want that. I wanted every story I told to have a specific meaning, a specific purpose, and like you said, a beginning, a middle, and an end. Mm-hmm. And that while I certainly leave some pathways open and some connections to be made between one miniseries and the next, each one is supposed to be its own story.
Well, every one of them is great. And from my perspective, it seems to me like your little Mouse Guard is getting bigger and bigger as time goes along. Because in the past, I would see you at Baltimore, and you would have some people talking with you, but not a lot. But then gratefully, I was so glad that you get to do the cover on their convention program.
I would have to do that. That was an amazing opportunity.
That was so great. And the thing that was great to me was I saw you had a nice long line of people waiting to talk with you, waiting to buy your stuff. And I was so happy to see that because I just think this is one of the underrated books that's out today.
Oh, thank you.
I just think it ought to be.
I get plenty of praise, so I'm grateful for anything that I get.
Well, I tell you, I wish this was in high school libraries. I wish it was everywhere that there's a kid that wants to read something that's profound and interesting and will increase their ability to understand storytelling. I think this should be there. I really wish there was some way to get them in there. I wish there was a program that schools would say, look, tell us what books are worth having and we'll buy them. And I could put this one in there. I'd be thrilled to recommend it because it just needs to be what people are reading.
I mean, I don't know of any national curriculum-based kind of thing that can happen there. But I do know that just on a ground level, I have a lot of high school teachers, middle school teachers, school librarians, and public librarians that let me know that Mouse Guard is an integral part of their collection. I've had even elementary school teachers make it part of their mythology curriculum.
Wow.
So there is progress being made in that way. And not just with Mouse Guard, but with quality graphic novels and things like Isagi Ojimbo and, I'm going to blank on other examples. I know Owly has been used in elementary schools. Bone has been used in high schools. There's lots of examples of it kind of getting past that barrier.
You know, somebody asked me one time books that they should use in their class, and I came up with two mouse books. It was just the funniest thing. Mouse Guard, of course, I told them. I also told them Mouse, M-A-U-S.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I said, these are two well-told stories. If you want to read something that's just going to pull you in and not let you go, these are the things, and you'll learn a lot about how stories are told. So I just, I was amused that the two things had to do with mice. I just thought they're funny.
That's true. I've done a couple library talks and presentations where I know the people that I'm addressing are non-graphic novel people. These are not people who are convinced that graphic novels are anything more than long comic books.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have a right to be a media that has the same kind of caliber quality as film or novels or anything like that. And I'll point out that Mouse, M-A-U-S, won the Pulitzer. And then I point out there is no Pulitzer for comics. It won Pulitzer for literature.
Awesome.
Just to be aware that comics are a very valid form of storytelling.
I think so, especially if somebody is reading is not their strong point. Maybe their English is not their first language or something like that. I think they could view the pictures and really understand what the story is going forward. So I tell everybody I can. I did want to communicate one story to you. When I was at C2E2, I was at a friend's booth, and they were selling stuff, and a woman came up and asked me if we had Mouse Guard, and I said, no, we don't, but I can tell you where you can. David Peterson's booth is over there at such a number. If you go over there, you'll find out that they have them. And she shot off in that direction, and later on I saw her walking towards our booth holding several hardcovers of it, and I was like, yeah, good.
That's great.
Because that's,
thanks for sending her my way.
Well, that's the kind of thing. I really do think this is the book that people, if they're not reading, should be. So I just kind of like that. By the way, now that Black Axe is over, have you gotten any kind of response from folks as to how the story ended? Were people happy with the story ending? Did you get a lot of feedback?
I haven't had as much this time. When Winter ended, I got a lot of response. I mean, I know already, having two of the main arcs out as hardcovers, that, and this is only progressing, that the audience is shifting from issue format to hardcover collection. So I already know that there's a good portion of my regular audience that hasn't read any of Black Axe yet because it's hardcover.
Okay.
And I'm attributing most of the lack of response to that so far. I've had a few. I've had some people tell me that it was meaningful and heartfelt and that there were parts, even at the end, that made them cry.
Yeah.
And without spoiling anything with the end, I have a bit in the last couple pages of issue 6 of Black Axe, or the very end of Black Axe, that ties things up, but at the same time is a huge tease to make you want more. And almost unfairly, because it's going to be a while before I get to giving you that part that you're wanting next.
Well, it teared me up. I'll weigh in on that, too. I remember reading it and just sitting there just
torn up. And I said, man, I said, this is just a great story. I love a story that can make me happy at one minute, and then I turn the page, and all of a sudden the tears are starting to flow. And that's the way Mouse Guard is. It's just so great about that. I think one of the things that may be happening is you've set a standard really high, and you maintain that quality. And so I think before people were sort of like, wow, this is great. I was surprised by it. Now we kind of expect that you're going to tell great stories. So maybe people aren't as interested to communicate because, yeah, he knows it's a good story. We've told him that before. So I think that's pretty cool. So, well, why don't we move on to the next book? When this episode airs, the first issue will be out, and so people will have had a chance to see it, and that's the next volume of Legend of the Guard.
Yeah.
Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Sure. Well, we did a Legends of the Guard volume already, kind of before Black Axe got going. Essentially, Legends of the Guard is a spin-off anthology series where I handpick comic creators, sometimes people who haven't even done comics, but artists and storytellers who I think are a good fit for the Mouse Guard world, that I admire their work, and that I trust them enough to be able to tell some kind of fun, tall tale within the Mouse Guard world. It's framed in such a way where there's a mouse tavern, and in that tavern, the mice are telling stories to try to clear off their bar tabs. Whoever gets the best story has their debt forgiven. Mm-hmm. I draw all of the tavern scenes, tavern mice. As soon as one of them goes into their story, into their contribution, that's when one of the guest artists gets to shine, gets to do their job. Mm-hmm. The first volume won the Eisner for Best Anthology the year that it came out. And I'm looking forward to sharing a whole nother round of folks this time. We've got some really good contributors, like Stan Sakai and Eric Canetti and Corey Godby, Ben Caldwell, Bill Willingham, and it's a really good list.
Now, it's going to be four issues, right?
Four issues long. Each issue has three contributors, three stories.
Mm-hmm. The one that I've seen and I like has an interesting kind of fantasy feel to it is Ben Caldwell's one, A Bone to Pick.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting to me is that I'm noticing, because one of the things you and I have talked about in the past is the fact that the mice are less anthropomorphic than I'm used to in other things.
Right.
And I always liked that because, you know, Mighty Mouse always, to me, looked like a human with a mouse head on. And I always enjoyed the fact that your mice look like real mice if they could actually stand up and hold a sword or something. Mm-hmm. So I like that. But I noticed that the other people aren't restricted to that. Like in Ben Caldwell's, for example, the two mice start out that we're seeing are walking along basically like people do.
Yeah, yeah. And I wouldn't want to restrict those people. I like Ben's work, and I like how much energy he puts in, and I like the humor that he uses. So I see every one of these different contributions between the artistic differences with my stuff and the narration differences, the panel differences. I see that as being the visualization of the distinct quality of the mouse's voice, who's telling the story within the tale.
Mm-hmm.
Even if you had the same joke to tell and your mother told it versus your 3-year-old nephew told it or someone else in your life told it, it would be very different depending on who was saying it. And so I see the visual differences, the fact that I never break a panel border. Well, some of these contributors might.
Mm-hmm.
I tend to make my mice try to look more natural. Ben's are a little bit more of an animated style, and I think that's like a more lighthearted tonal quality to the story and to the voice of the mouse that's telling it.
Mm-hmm.
It tells you about the character who's telling the story. The way the story looks kind of explains maybe some of their personality.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's another one. There's only one page, and I'm not exactly sure who's drawing it, but it's got a mouse. He's chasing after what looks like a leaf or something, and he's running, and all of a sudden he's got the last panel on the page. He's got his eyes are bugged out, and his mouth is open. So he's obviously chasing after something.
Ah, that's Stan Sakai. That's Usagi Yojimbo's Stan Sakai.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. It looks different than Usagi. He did it as a mostly watercolor piece. It has ink outlines, but instead of the cross-hatching and stippling that we're known for with Usagi, he kind of stepped outside of those constraints and got to have a little bit more experimentation time. It's a beautiful story.
That's great. I'm looking forward to it because I haven't had a chance to read it as of the time we're recording it, but it looks great. Now, the other one that I see, and it looks a lot more painted, is one where there's whales involved. Who's doing that one?
That's a team collaboration. The writer's name is Nick Tapolansky, and the artist's name is Alex Ekman-Lawn. They put out a book through Archaea called Awakening. It was a kind of a zombie noir horror thriller book. which you wouldn't immediately think, oh, that's a good fit for Mouse Guard. But over the years, at various conventions, sitting at the Arkea booth and signing and you know, rubbing elbows with the other contributors, Nick, Alex, and I got to be pretty good friends. And even though that was the book they were working on, I knew that story-wise and story sensibility-wise, we all had a lot of common ground. Mm-hmm. And then there's a funny story, which is that early on, I think maybe the first or second time I ever met Nick and Alex, I had a line for Mouse Guard, and I don't even think their book had come out yet, so there weren't a whole lot of people stopping to say hello to them because people weren't even aware of their book. Mm-hmm. And discouraged a little, or just making a joke about sitting there with nobody visiting them, Nick mm-hmm. said, "That's it. I'm going to do one of these guard books. I'm going to do one called Whale Guard." And I thought it was funny, and I happened to rip off the flap of a cardboard box that was under the table, and I quickly drew a whale with a cloak, mm-hmm. and I wrote, "Whale Guard, you have my approval to do this, David Peterson," and I handed it to Nick. And he said, "No one's going to believe it. It needs your DNA." And I licked the corner of the cardboard and said, "There you go." And so we've always kind of laughed about Whale Guard and how funny that was. Mm-hmm. And when it came time to do Legends of the Guard Volume 2 and I was rounding up contributors, I said to Nick, "If you're interested, I think I've actually figured out a way." And I don't usually add story input to the contributors, but this time I said, "I think I've figured out a way, I think I've figured out an angle where you could do a Whale Guard story, but still have it not a joke like we were talking about, but actually kind of make it fit within the world of Mouse Guard and be believable and not be tongue-in-cheek." So he was open to kind of the tone I felt he could set, and then from there he wrote a really fun story, and Alex did a beautiful job of painting it and getting the sense of the scale, which I think is really important for Mouse Guard, the scale of the difference between the size of a mouse and the size of something else. There's a panel where a mouse who's kind of magically able to be underwater is coming in contact with a whale, and the mouse is right next to the whale's eye, and that's all you see is the mouse and the whale's eye, just to give you a sense of, like, this animal is so big, the only thing we could fit in the panel is its eye.
Well, I think it's kind of cool because the page that I can see, they don't dress up like the mice do with capes and stuff. They have, like, shells or something covering the front of their heads. And I just kind of think that's a neat thing. I'm grateful that they didn't turn out to be like, you know, like the mice. It was nice that they took their own spin on things. And I thought that was really cool to see. I'm looking forward to that story.
Yeah. And Nick and I talked about that, too. Because, I mean, initially when I did that little doodle with the whale with the cloak, we were joking and it was a parody kind of a thing. But I said, "I think you can actually do this in a way that's believable, to think that maybe the whales have their own civilization and their own culture and everything, so that it really nests well within Mouse Guard." And then, just like every Legends of the Guard story, the point of these are that they're the tall tales, they're the legends. It might not actually fit perfectly into regular Mouse Guard continuity. I'm not actually saying that those whales are out there doing those things. But as a fairy tale, it works well, and even with a little ounce of believability.
I'm going to be fascinated to see, because oftentimes to the mice and Mouse Guard, larger animals are enemies.
Yes.
And so I'm going to be fascinated to see if this is a Whale Guard of sorts. They're not going to necessarily be enemies. They're going to be protectors as well. So they're probably going to look at the mice as someone that they're supposed to protect.
Yeah, I don't want to spoil too much.
Yeah, so I got to read the stories. Yeah, I want to read the stories. That's right. Yeah, so it'll be out by the time,
this has come out. So.
Yeah, oh, man, I can't wait to see it.
I don't want to spoil it for you. I don't want to
No, that's fine. I hope that that'll encourage people to pick up the book if we don't necessarily spoil all the good stuff.
Yeah.
Now, one thing I notice that you always do, and you're doing it again with Legends of the Guard that I really like, is you do the wraparound covers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they're great fun to look at, and I think sometimes you should put these out in, like, poster format. So we can put them up on the walls because they're just so neat to look at.
Thanks.
And this one has got it looks like the one mouse is there, and he's got, like, salamanders around him.
Yeah. Actually, from time to time, we use my own role-playing game. We use the Mouse Guard role-playing game that Luke Crane wrote to go through and see if there's something that we've included in the role-playing game that I haven't had an opportunity to draw yet, either for whatever reason. I didn't feel like it at the time, or it hadn't actually fit into the right spot in the Mouse Guard stories. And there's a list of all the animals and predators that you could possibly interact with in the Mouse Guard role-playing game, and salamanders was on that list. I thought, oh, I haven't drawn a salamander yet. And at the same time, I've been really inspired by an illustrator's work. His name's Jean-Baptiste Mon. And he's a French artist who now lives in Canada, and he does a lot of design work for the animation industry, but he does these beautiful fantasy illustrations, kind of in the spirit of Alan Lee or Brian Froud or Paul Bonner or John Bauer. Mm-hmm. And Jean-Baptiste has been doing these illustrations of very real-looking animals with little elves and sprites and pixies and those kind of things, gnomes, that are either riding the animals or using them at, like, in animal husbandry where they're towing a cart or something like that. And a lot of the times, these animals are just packed down. He's put kind of saddlebags on them and then a stack of boxes, and those are lashed together, and sticking out of it's a fishing pole, and you can see a banjo lashed on somewhere, and jugs of wine or water, and just all kinds of stuff. I got to meet Jean-Baptiste a couple months ago. I was complimenting him on these on that specific thing, and he said, I try to put in everything that looks like it would make a good trip. So the idea, you know, no matter where you're going, these things would ensure that it would be a good time. So he puts on, you know, wine and comfy-looking blankets and banjos and candles and bells and all kinds of good stuff. And I love that, and I thought it would be fun to have the salamanders on the cover of Legends of the Guard number one, being kind of like pack mules that are leading an explorer mouse down into a wet and damp cave. And just like with all the Legends covers, each cover actually is a legend in and of itself. I did a little one-paragraph write-up on the inside to explain what legend that cover is covering. And cool. I actually tied it in with a bit of real Mouse Guard history that I haven't actually explored in the comics yet, but that I have in my own personal history bank for Mouse Guard, which is about a city called Copperwood that has some wealth, also has some corruption, but that underneath Copperwood is a large copper mine, which is why it's called Copperwood. And this Legends cover kind of chronicles how Copperwood used to be called something else, and then it was this mouse discovering the copper mine that led to it being renamed and changed the city's fate.
Cool. So might we see that again sometime in the future?
At some point, yes. I definitely want to do a Copperwood story. I don't have a story that it already naturally fits in, and I'm almost wondering if I have to do a story that almost takes place entirely within Copperwood so that I can get to show all the parts that I want to instead of just trying to squeeze it into an existing story.
Cool. Well, you know, you can always do a separate miniseries or a one issue.
Yeah. I've thought about it. Might be a fun single issue kind of a thing, or like an annual or something. I don't know. I have visions of Copperwood being kind of like a medieval Dickens type city, like, you know, the way Dickens portrayed London. It'd be like that, except more medieval setting than kind of Victorian, Edwardian Victorian.
Mm-hmm. You know, I have to tell you, the cover is so realistic that it harkened me back to my childhood. When I was growing up, my family used to have a trailer outside of a lake in northeastern Pennsylvania. And one of the things we used to do around was go around and collect the salamanders. And it looked so realistic. Boy, I just immediately snapped back to the trailer back there. And I said, wow, I said, that reminds me of the salamanders that I used to chase around. Because when we were kids, you know, you always want to collect them and watch them and learn about them and stuff like that. We wouldn't kill them. When we were going home, we would always dump them out and put them back in the wild. But it looked so real to me that I immediately went right back to that trailer and right back to that time. So that's one of the things I enjoy about your stuff, is that it's anchored in reality so well that it just brings out stuff to me when I look at it. So I like that a lot.
Thank you. I feel like Mouse Guard on the surface is a little bit of a silly premise, in that I'm asking you as an adult to believe that there are mice who are walking on their hind legs and talking, and they have a whole medieval civilization, and they wield weapons, and they fight large predators without instantly being killed. And that's all very unbelievable and hard to believe. So I try to ground everything else in Mouse Guard as closely to reality as I can as an artist and storyteller. So the backgrounds are always more well-rendered and more detailed than the mice are. And same with the predators. I try to stay a little bit more on nature model for the predators than for the mice.
Well, you know, even though they're drawn a little more simply, I pull for the mice every time. And when they get in danger, I am sitting there just going, oh, my gosh, I got to turn the page and find out what happened. Because I don't want anything to happen to them. Because, you know, I just think that they, you know, you draw them as the way that I like mice to look. You know, there are other versions of them around, and they and rats and things all look very differently. But they're in such a way that I feel for them. I want them to survive, and I want them to do well. And so when they're in danger, I am just anxious.
Well, thank you.
That's great. Now, is this going to be bi-monthly? How's this going to come out?
You know what? I think this is coming out monthly. I just realized that's a really good question. I'm almost positive this is coming out monthly.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Well, that'd be great. Well, it's even better.
Yeah, so, it's In fact, everybody's stories are turned in. All 12 have now turned in their stories. I still have my pages to do for issue 4. In fact, I'm a little behind on it. But I have my pages for issue 4 yet to do. But issues 1, 2, and 3 are already done and turned into Archaea. And then on my plate this week, I'm also supposed to be getting the cover for the hardcover collection done, as well as touching base with the epilogue contributor. Just like with the first Legends. In the first Legends, I had a fun little Easter egg in that throughout the whole story, and as the viewers are getting to see all these mice in the June Alley and in the tavern, I had one mouse on a bench who was sleeping. Mm-hmm. And you don't always see her. You just, every now and then, you'd notice, oh, there's a mouse still there. Oh, issue 3, she's still there. She's still sleeping. Mm-hmm. So for the epilogue, I decided to show a panel. I drew a panel of her on the bench still sleeping and then had a guest artist, João Lemos, tell what she's dreaming of. Mm-hmm. And then the last panel, I drew another panel of her still asleep. So she's still sound asleep and dreaming that dream. This time we're going to do another epilogue kind of like that. It's going to be a different character, and I'm not going to reveal who it is or what the fun little twist is of who it is and why they're telling the story. But
okay, we got to buy the book.
I mean, I can tell that the Dirk Shearer is the artist who's doing the
cool,
but I won't tell any more than that.
Well, of course, we got to buy it, and that's always a good thing. So now, you're doing cons again this summer. You usually have like plates to put into books.
Mm-hmm.
If people want to just get your autograph and just put it inside rather than get it on somewhere else.
Yeah.
What stuff are you selling this year at the cons?
I'll still be doing the book plates. I started doing the book plates because a frequent thing was happening where I'd show up at a convention and someone would say, "I didn't know you were going to be here. I didn't read the list to see who was coming. I have all my MouseGuard books at home and I wanted you to sign them and now I don't have them with me." Mm-hmm. The best I could offer was, "I guess I'll see you next year at this same convention."
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, that just seems silly. So I decided to do a nice little art print that's smaller in size that has my signature. They're also numbered. And it says, "This book belongs to." So they can write their name in, and then they can paste it into their own book. They can paste it into a MouseGuard book, or they could paste it into any book they wanted, really. Mm-hmm. And then I do a new one every year, so that way they get to be a fun little collectible, and they can add to their MouseGuard collection and put them in different books and such. But I'll have those. I'll have other prints, like full-size poster prints. I'll have T-shirts. And the way I'm doing the T-shirts is I'll do a design, and we have them printed locally. My wife and I actually drive out and talk to the printer and talk to the screen printer, and we proof everything as it comes off. But then once we have that run printed, that's it for that design. When it sells out, they're done, and we do a new design, a new color, a new everything. So we're actually going into San Diego. We still haven't completely confirmed with the printer that we'll have the shirts in time for San Diego, but that's our goal, that we'll have a new shirt to debut for San Diego.
Cool. I always have to ask, because I'm what they call a little too jolly for the smaller sizes. Are you going to have like the XL and XXL kind of things?
Yes.
Or you are? Okay.
Yeah. The shirt that we're having printed currently is the third one of these that we've done. The first time that we did a shirt, we didn't really know what sizes were going to be the most purchased and what to do, and we went a little cautiously. I think we just went up to XL, and that's as far as we went. But with the second one, we went up to 2 and 3 XL. We didn't print as many of them. We only did a few of each of those. But we were able to kind of gauge, based on how many people were asking for what sizes with that second run, what we need to do now with this third. So, yeah, we'll have some larger sizes. We also have ladies' sizes that are kind of tailored in the middle so that it cuts in on the sides a bit and has a nice, cute little cap sleeve.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah. So we're doing T-shirts and, like I said, prints. I always take original art to conventions. I'll have my original art for sale. And people who want to get commissions from me can either get inked commissions that they arrange before the show, or I do watercolor commissions at the show.
So how do they get a hold of you if they want to order a commission like that?
For the commissions, I put them up as an item in my store about the week before the convention starts.
Okay.
And if you go to the mouseguard.net website, there's a link for online store, and that's where you would go to find that. There's also, if you just want to contact me and ask me a question about anything, you can contact me either through the MouseGuard website. There's a contact link there, or you can hit me up on Twitter. I'm at MouseGuard.
Okay, that makes sense. Now, we mentioned that you were at Baltimore last year, and you'd done the cover, but it'll be neat to see you again at Baltimore, because I think Baltimore is one of the growing conventions, and it's purely a comic book convention,
is.
Which is one of the things I really like.
I love that, too. I respect Mark Nathan for keeping it as such. I think there's kind of three conventions that really need an extra pat on the back, an extra round of applause from comic fans and professionals, and that's Emerald City, Heroes, and Baltimore. All three of those conventions are run by individuals. They're not corporations. And nothing against the corporations. I love C2E2. I enjoy San Diego. New York Comic Con's a great time. But those are run by big companies that have lots and lots and lots of employees, and their job is to put on that convention. The other three conventions that I mentioned are individuals that run their own comic book stores and have lots of other things that they could and should be doing. And they get together a ragtag team of employees from their store and other volunteers and other professionals, and they put on a comic book show that has a guest list that rivals those big conventions. And all three of those are also comic book only conventions. They don't go in for the other media stuff. And the media stuff can be fun, but when you're an art lover and a storyteller lover and you're going to a convention, I feel like the number one thing that a convention can do is put the fan in touch with the people making the product. Going to a convention to buy stuff that you can buy from Amazon or from your local comic book store seems like it's a pretty silly reason to put on a convention. And the bigger important thing is making that connection between fan and creator.
Well, I agree with that because it gives people a chance to get to ask questions and get to know, you know, little things that they want to know about the books. And I just always think, you know, word of mouth is such a great thing. And this is why, like I said, when people come up to me and ask me what books I recommend, I'll always include that in there just because it's important for people to know quality stuff. And you know, a lot of people don't know other people who read comics. They go to the store, they buy their stuff, they go home, and there's really nobody that recommends stuff to them.
Sure.
So I always think it's important for them to go to people, and when somebody actually asks me, I really try to give them good recommendations. My mouse guard's always in there, so I just think it's great stuff. What other cons are you going to be at this year?
What other cons? I should look at my list so that I can read a good list to you without forgetting something, so that some of the podcast doesn't go, wait, he didn't say such and such convention. Why didn't he be there?
Yeah.
Okay, so for the rest of the year, it looks like I'm going to be doing the San Diego Comic Convention. Boston Comic Con, which was just recently added, and truth be told, the reason that I've been to Boston before, I like the organizers and everything, it wasn't one that was on my list for this year because I'm supposed to be home trying to get more work done and all of that, but Joe Hill and Gabe Rodriguez, the creative team for Lock and Key, are going to be at Boston Comic Con, and as soon as I saw them there, I said, I have to go because I need to get my book signed, so I'm having my own little fan moment. So Boston Comic Con, of course I'll be at Baltimore, I'll be at New York Comic Con, and then also the North Carolina Comic Con, or NC Comic Con.
Oh, cool.
And I think that rounds me out for the rest of the year.
Okay, well that's good. Now, you mentioned briefly earlier that there were ideas you had for going forward. Do you know what you're going to be doing after Legends of the Guard concludes?
I am going to be taking a little bit of a mouse break.
Okay.
But I want your listeners to be rest assured I'm coming back to MouseGuard. I see MouseGuard as my life's project. I just need to get a little bit of a battery recharge before I jump in. And I know it seems like it's been a long time since books have come out anyhow, and that I probably already had that break. I really didn't. Between fall and winter and Legends and the role-playing game and the role-playing game box set and Black Axe and now Legends 2... there really hasn't been a moment where I wasn't doing something related to MouseGuard. I'm going to take a little bit of a break and do some kind of other project. I haven't decided what it is. I have a couple ideas and things that I've had on the back burner for years, and I just think if I do some kind of nice little, like maybe 48-page self-contained book that lets me finally get to one of those little projects, that would be a nice vacation, keep me still moving creatively, and then get me ready for the next big MouseGuard arc, which just to prove that I'm already thinking ahead, I already know what the next thing's going to be. It's the Weasel War of 1149. It's a war that I've kind of hinted at through the two first volumes of MouseGuard, and it takes place about 3 years before fall, and I want to chronicle that event and try to do what I did in Black Axe, which was that even though I was telling a prequel story, the whole goal of telling a prequel story is to just deepen the mythos and add weight and understanding to things that you already know. I'm not trying to just show things that I've kind of hinted at. I want to actually deepen your understanding and appreciation and also show you where the mice have been so that when we get stories that take place after winter, you'll have more appreciation for where they're going.
Mm-hmm. Very cool. Very cool. Now, of course, last time you and I talked, you were doing covers for Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. Yeah. Are you still doing that?
No, I did 8 covers for them. There was an opportunity to do a couple more, another one of their runs, and it just didn't work out scheduling-wise. So, I mean, there's always the potential that I could get in there and do some more, but it's just going to come down to scheduling.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But I'd love to. I love them. Yeah. They're part of the reason I got into comics.
Yeah, I remember you were all excited that you were going to get to do those covers and stuff, and I bought them because I bought them for the cover. I mean, I like the story well enough, but your art was what drew me into them, made me buy them because I really like that. But I know you're a Turtles fan. It's always fun to me when a creator likes other creators' stuff. So I think that's kind of how you guys support each other and stuff.
I mean, I'm a fan. I came in to this, I wanted to draw comics since I was a kid, but when I got to go to the conventions and set up as a professional, I think I was more excited to be just that close to all these people. Cause, oh my gosh, look, there's Jeff Darrow, there's Mike Mignola, there's Scotty Young. There are all these people that I admire their work. And there's Kevin Eastman. I'm in the same building. I'm sitting on the same side of the table as they are. That was almost as exciting, if not more so, than just, being there on my own book.
Very cool. Well, my hope is that your name will become up to those levels, too, and someday that you'll have people coming to you and saying, David Peterson, I get to work with him, or I get to sit in the tables next to him, because I just think that...
I'm grateful that it already happens, actually, and it makes me really uncomfortable, because in my mind, I'm still a young pup in this industry, and I feel like they're looking to me for some kind of big advice, and I just feel like I'm still figuring this stuff out myself. I don't know that I can help you with much, but it's flattering. I just got back from a convention where the guy next to me was saying, I'm so sorry. I'm sorry to be geeking out, but I can't believe I'm sitting next to David Peterson. I mean, you're a guy who made it.
So. Well, that's a real compliment. I think that people do that. Mouse Guard, I expect great things going forward. I expect this to go for quite a long time, and boy, am I looking forward to all the good stories you have to tell that we haven't read yet.
Yeah.
Much success, David, and I look forward to talking with you again in the future. Maybe when the next round is going to start up, I'll get a chance to talk with you.
All right, sounds good.
On a long journey to Glenstone, I sailed right into its shade. There before me, she proudly shone. My decision was already made. Alas, who bore the light of the town? Her fur of ivory thread. How she danced is stuck in my crown, and back to this glen my boat led. 20-some seasons have since passed, since her eyes and mine both met. Through lands unnamed and wildly vast, my blade slaying every thread. Wolf, hawk, fox, and snake can't stand in my way. My body is weak and it may break, though not today.
Need dramatic examples to shake them out of apathy, and I can't do that as Bruce Wayne. As a man, I'm flesh and blood. I can be ignored, I can be destroyed, but as a symbol.
Get the latest from the comics universe. News, interviews, previews, and reviews. Listen to the weekly Wayne's Comics Podcast so you can keep reading your comics.
Now at MajorSpoilers.com.
time again for our news and previews, and with me this week is Steve Davis returning. How are you doing, Steve?
Not too bad. How are you?
Pretty good, pretty good. Why don't we start off by asking if you're planning on seeing the Lone Ranger movie?
Well, I plan on seeing it. I've seen the trailers, and the trailers look pretty good. To me, Clayton Moore will always be the Lone Ranger, but, you know, there's been how many James Bonds? So, you know, it's been a while, so, you know, give it a shot.
Yeah, I have to say that I don't think that Mr. Depp is a good choice for Tonto. He's got this strange-looking bird sitting on his head, and it flaps around every time I see action or wind happening. So I think it's going to look like a distraction to me. But, I mean, it's done by the people who did Pirates, which was a very successful franchise. I imagine a lot of people will be going to see it just because of that. I'm going to be curious to see about it. I'm not certain how I'm going to like it or not, so we'll have to see when I get a chance to look at it.
My only question is why they couldn't have found a Native American to play Tonto.
Yeah, you know, I'm waiting for Johnny Depp to play a black person next.
Okay.
I mean, why not? You know, it's politically correct. Apparently people want to see him be a Tonto, and I'm just kind of like, I'm surprised people aren't screaming more that this should have been an American Indian. I just don't get that. So, but anyway, what we'll do is we'll go with that. Now, why don't we go ahead and move into some of the news. Recently, we found out that Robert Downey Jr. is returning for the next two Avengers movies. Now, he doesn't say he's going to be Iron Man. We just know that he's likely to be Tony Stark. So what's your reaction to that?
I'm not surprised. I would have been surprised if he didn't come back. I mean, you know, I'm sure they offered him what they needed to offer him to come back, and it seems like he's having a good time playing it. So that really didn't surprise me at all. I am a little curious as to why they haven't said, yes, he's doing another Iron Man film.
Yeah, it may be that he's kind of gotten tired of that. After three of them, normally actors only want to do about three, and then they get want to move on to other things.
Well, that's
so I'm
true.
Kind of
that's
thinking
true. But there's something else to think about here. He's also known now, and I wish I counted this up earlier, he's also known for playing another role more than once, that being Sherlock Holmes.
Right.
And Basil Rathbone played Holmes how many times, and Christopher Lee did the same thing. They played this character, Sherlock Holmes, over and over, and maybe he'll do the same thing with that. But I'm thinking, was there any reason not to expect him to play Iron Man over and over and over as long as he's enjoying himself and getting paid good?
I don't know. I guess he's making plenty of money. The one thing I had trouble with in the last Iron Man film was that he was Tony Stark so much of the time, and actually Jarvis controlled the armor better than he did, I thought. So they kind of made it look like they don't really want him to be Iron Man anymore. And, of course, when you're an actor, you don't want your face covered up by Iron Man armor. So I have a feeling he's going to want to be more of a leader, kind of sitting back and saying, all right, you guys go out and fight the bad guys. I'm going to sit here and work on my armor.
Well, that would be something interesting because you wouldn't expect that. You expect him out doing the suit. So I didn't even think about that. So that's a very good possibility. But to also keep in mind, we're talking about the Avengers. We're talking about an ensemble group. It's not just Iron Man. There's Captain America. There's Black Widow. There's Thor. There's, and you know, the new movie, Quicksilver, and I believe Scarlet Witch will be thrown in the mix. So,
yeah. I'm going to be kind of curious because I bet you they're looking to put War Machine more in these just to provide a diversity factor as far as Avengers goes.
Yeah.
So
you know,
we'll
it's not
see
going to be
it.
Loki.
Now, they said Loki's out. He's gone. This actor is not going to be in there. And that's kind of interesting because he's been one of the people going out supporting these films, you know, verbally. He's been going and doing interviews and talking about how great it is to have all these Marvel characters in movies.
Right.
So I'm just kind of intrigued that they've decided not to use him anymore.
Well, I'm not really surprised by that despite all that he's done for them, simply because Loki has gone up against Thor. He's gone up against the Avengers. We've seen it on screen twice now. If they were to do this a third time, you'd be scratching your head thinking, wait a minute, what about the other villains Marvel has?
Yeah.
This guy twice now has had something new. Doesn't mean he can't come back later.
Yeah. Yeah, it'll be interesting to see. So apparently Avengers 2 in 2015 and Avengers 3, which is not yet set in the scope of things, is going to have Tony Stark at least in it. So we'll see what happens with that.
Sure.
Now, it's something interesting. Of course, one of the things that's going on in comics is the fact that there is what's called Superior Spider-Man. I don't know if you're up on that story.
I am not up on that story.
Okay, what's going on is that Spider-Man has been replaced in Peter Parker's body by Dr. Octopus.
Mm-hmm.
And so Dr. Octopus is actually living a new life in Peter Parker's body, which means that, and the part that creeps me out is that he's making a pass at Mary Jane on occasion. And so he's not just going to be Amazing Spider-Man, he's going to be superior because he's Dr. Octopus. So it's not unusual for them to be making changes in the spider characters at this point. And one of the stories that's coming up is that Venom is going to get a new member of the family. You know, we've had Carnage, who was a red kind of Venom, and of course Venom, who's changed people. Flash Thompson now actually has the symbiote and using it in there. And now we're getting a new character called Mania. It's going to be a female spider character and going to be wearing a black outfit that looks very similar to the symbiote. So you have to figure it's a piece of the Venom symbiote going on, and they're going off and doing these things. And the question is going to be is, you know, it's, and Venom, of course, has his own book with Flash Thompson in it, and that's been going on. He moved to Philly. They lost Rick Remender as the writer, and they moved into Colin Bunn as the guy. And I'm just sort of interested to see what's going to happen moving forward. I think they're taking their cue from what's going on with Superior Spider-Man by introducing a new Venom character. And I tell you something, if Flash Thompson loses the symbiote, it'll be an interesting thing. So what's your reaction to that?
I don't know. We'll see what we'll see. I think it's just, personally, I think it's too many Venoms. I think one Venom really is enough. But, you know, if it works, it works.
Mm-hmm. Well, they need a female in that family now, and so I think that's why this Mania is coming in. But I'm going to be really curious to see what happens, because Flash Thompson, of course, is a well-known character in the Spider-Man family, and him being able to get his legs back, he lost his legs over in war over in the Middle East, apparently, and the character of Venom gets those legs back for him. So, of course, they're always wondering about Eddie Brock, and he's bumped into Eddie Brock a time or two, at my understanding. And he used to be the Venom character, and the guy had a personal hatred for Peter Parker, right, as well as what the symbiote had. And now this female character is going to be something interesting, another introduction of characters. It just fascinates me that we're doing all these changes to the Spider-Man character and in the family. And, of course, I always like to point out that I'm sure that when Amazing Spider-Man 2 was just about to hit, Peter Parker will be back in Peter Parker's body where he belongs.
Right.
And we'll see what happens with these Venom characters. I mean, you know, before long, we're going to have all these Venoms running around. And it's going to be like the Borg on Star Trek.
Sure.
You're going to burn it out so badly that people are just going to go, well, another Borg. Oh, my goodness. And the problem is every time you introduce into one of these characters, you water down the whole concept. And I'm afraid that's what's going to happen with Venom here.
That's why I said I think it's best just to have one. And you have, like, you know, a female Venom, a grandmother Venom, a Venom dog. Where's it in?
Yeah, it reminds me of that Hulk movie where we had the irradiated poodle that was running around. Oh, that was just the most – I remember sitting in the theater, and when it came on, everybody in the theater where I was laughed. And I thought, oh, man, I said, that's a big mistake, big mistake. But with Marvel's House of Ideas, not always good ones, but ideas anyway. So it's going to be something to see what happens with that. But that's – in light of what's going on in Spider-Man, I'm not terribly surprised. – I guess on related notes, the next two Amazing Spider-Man movies are set for 2016 and 2018. Did you get to see Amazing Spider-Man, by the way?
The most recent one, the reboot? Yeah, I did. I liked it.
Yeah, it was okay. I'm not nearly as interested with what's going on with it. I thought that this was supposed to be fitting in between the Tobey Maguire movies as a story, but apparently it was a total reboot when I watched it.
No, it's a reboot. It's a total reboot. I didn't think I was going to like it. I did like it. I still prefer the older movies, the Tobey Maguire movies. I just prefer those to this new one, but I still like the new one.
It's going to be interesting to see what they do. And, of course, we know that the Spider-Man villain in the next film is going to be Electro, which is going to be interesting. Jamie Foxx looking like, I don't know if you remember, when Superman got the electric powers, and he had a blue costume. And now, apparently, Electro looks blue. And similar to that, if you've ever watched Ultimate Spider-Man on the Disney Channel or Disney XD, they've actually had him looking like blue and all electric-y all over. So it's because he's not a black guy in the Ultimate Spider-Man thing, but it's going to be interesting how that works.
You see, I hear a lot of people griping about the race change and the costume change. I'm not really too worried about that. We've seen this before with Nick Fury, and that worked out okay. As far as the costume change, they have to change the costume. And the costume, you'd look ridiculous on the screen if he's going to be played seriously. It's the same reason the X-Men didn't have their yellow costumes. In fact, there's one scene in the, I think, the first X-Men movie where they had the costumes on their airplane, and I guess it was like a backup costume, and Wolverine looked at it with disgust.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're always making fun of things that in the comics wouldn't make sense on the screen. And I get that. You know, that I actually thought that first X-Men movie was pretty good. The later ones got to me, I thought, but it's just an interesting thing how the Marvel stuff. Now, interestingly enough, of course, Spider-Man is farmed out to Sony.
Yeah.
He's not part of the Marvel stuff. And one of the things I like to point out is that Iron Man 3 was called in the press a Disney movie, not a Marvel movie. And I always found that an interesting way to phrase it, because the whole point of setting up Marvel Studios was so Marvel got control of these characters. And to call it a Disney film is, well, it's changing the focus.
Well, here's another thing is that Disney, I don't know if they're still using this name or not, but Buena Vista used to be a, I don't say marketing, but it was the one, the distribution firm. And it distributed a lot of movies, not just of Disney, but of other studios as well. They had the contract to do that. And I could be wrong here, but I can't help but wonder if it's the same type of situation.
Well, it could be. And they used to have films that used to, from a company called Touchstone.
Yeah.
And so I'm just curious about that. I think the Disney name is becoming one of the biggest conglomerates and actually one of the biggest groups that actually controls almost, you know, so much of the media that some people might get a little nervous seeing how big it is now. But it's going to be interesting to see. So that's another interesting story. Let's move into one that I think is really kind of fun. Did you ever read the Justice League back in the days when Keith Giffen, J.M. DeMatteis, and Kevin Maguire were working on it?
That's interesting. You asked that. That was my favorite run, I think, of any comic book series. And I didn't think I was going to like it back in the day, because this was right after, if we're talking about what I think you're talking about, it was right after, shortly after the original Crisis.
Yeah.
And they had the Suicide Squad and Captain Adams, some other titles came out. And I knew that the Justice League was going to be sort of a tongue-in-cheek thing. Didn't think I would care for it, because I thought they should be serious. And that was my favorite run.
Yeah, it was just wonderful. You know, it was just crazy silly at times, and yet Keith Giffen and those folks can do anything, running gags, they can do all kinds of crazy stuff, and you know, McGuire's art was just wonderful. He didn't last as long as the other two did on the book, but there was one sequence I always loved that I talk about where they've sent back in time, but they also get reduced in size as it, and they come across a robot that looks like a black man. And they're walking down the street, and they're trying to control this robot from inside, and they're not used to it. And so the legs are flying out, and the arms are swinging as they're trying to walk. And one other black guy turns and sees the robot and says, "Hey, man, you know, party on," kind of stuff, because it looks like he's doing like a street walk with them. God, that just made me howl. And the page before was so serious. And it just goes to show that these guys can do really all kinds of things. So it's kind of, the reason why we bring this up is that there's a new book coming out called Justice League 3000.
Right.
It's set in the distant future of the DC Universe. And, of course, it's going to have that original team back on it. And my understanding is that it's not going to be in the same tone. It's actually going to try to be a lot more serious than those books are.
Interesting.
Or at least have been. But it's going to be that creative team. And, of course, McGuire's art is just always stunning whenever he draws. And these guys are great. Giffen is the one who does a lot of the plotting. DeMatteis does a lot of the dialoguing. And he'll just do any old joke he can throw in there. And you'll see all kinds of stuff, you know, all kinds of running gags and stuff. Interestingly enough, DeMatteis and Giffen are working on a new book that just came out for Larfleeze, the Orange Lantern and the Green Lantern fame.
Yeah,
and first issue was a lot of fun. It was the typical DeMatteis given things, and I just loved that. I just thought it was such great stuff. And now we're going to have them do the future Justice League. You know, this isn't the only time that DC has done a future Justice League. There used to be a 52 million Justice League story or DC where in which they had all the characters transplanted into the future, because they figured the way that things go, it would take like 52 million years before all these characters would appear again. So this isn't the first time DC's done it, but this is the first time the New 52 has actually done it. So, and we've seen some art released on it, and it looks like it's going to start up in October. I mean, what's your take on how this is going to go?
It could go either way. We're talking about some people who have proved themselves in the past, and they're going to be doing a different take on the league, a future league, like you said. So, you know, I think they'll go either way. I don't think it's going to be one of those things that people will say, well, that was okay. I think we're going to say this is just awesome, or it's just going to bomb. It's going to be one or the other. I'm leaning towards awesome because I just have a lot of faith in these guys.
Well, when they say, and they've had interviews, they've talked about it, that it's just the whole thing about how this crazy stuff, and when these three guys get together, there's all kinds of chemistry going on.
Yeah.
You know, it's just special stuff happening, and I think it's going to be great fun of what it's going to do. And, you know, these guys have their great ways of telling stories, and I think it's going to be something special. I really do. How long it lasts and how much it goes on, it's just going to be a fun series, and I think it'll be a good thing because, you know, when these guys do things, it's going to be special.
Sure.
So now another thing that's happened, interestingly enough, related to this, Keith Giffen was actually working a little on the Legion, and the Legion of Superheroes now, for the first time, is actually going to cease production, and for the first time in years, DC is not going to have a Legion book. And a lot of people who are Legion fans are going like, what in the world? What's going to happen? But I have to say that they've struggled to make things work in the 31st century. And I'm not certain that they know what to do. They had Legion Lost, which was a monthly title, and they had Legion. And they brought in their old writer who'd written it way back in the past. And now he did a good job with it. But I don't think people related to the characters that much.
Could be.
So, I don't know. Did you ever get a chance to read those Legion books?
I didn't. I've never been a huge fan of the Legion, which is interesting because most people that I discuss comic books with are huge, huge, huge Legion fans. I just never could get into it. I think you're right, though. I think my gut feeling is that the powers that be are rethinking things concerning the Legion and whatever plans they had, say, when they started the New 52, they're now rethinking as far as the Legion goes and seeing how that's going to fit in what they're doing now. Mm-hmm. Now, I could be wrong. It's just how it looks from what I've been reading.
Mm-hmm. Now, one last bit of news, and I didn't get a chance to tell you about this ahead of time, but there was Superman Batman, and now there's Batman Superman. It's written by Greg Pak, and it's drawn by Jay Lee, who has a very unique art style. And apparently that's going to go so well, and they're going to use their major characters, that they're now starting up a Superman-Wonder Woman ongoing series in the same month in October. And, of course, you know, they've canceled recently a bunch of things in the New 52, so they need some books to fill some of those empty slots. And, you know, recently in the comic, which has gotten mixed reviews, it's been Superman and Wonder Woman have developed at a relationship.
Right.
And they've kind of moved Lois Lane off into other things, and they've got Wonder Woman going around with Superman, which actually, if you physically think about it, makes a lot of sense. I mean, Lois Lane should get destroyed if she ever tried to get it on with Superman, but Wonder Woman at least could withstand that. And so what they're going to do, and it's going to be written by Charles Soule, who's one of my favorite up-and-coming writers. He's working on Swamp Thing and doing a great job there, and he's got a lot of other books coming out. And one of my favorite pencilers who's also written is Tony Daniel, and he's going to be providing the art. So it's going to be an interesting thing. I'm going to be curious to see how people, either they warm up to it or they don't. It's going to be funny to see, you know, in the past we've had Lois Lane, Superman's girlfriend, and all this stuff. So it's kind of interesting that we're, in a sense, taking what Brian Azzarello is doing over in Wonder Woman and combining it with what's going on in the Superman books. That'll be an interesting twist to think. Does that sound intriguing to you at all?
Well, it does in a way, and I'll tell you why I wasn't too keen on this. I think about a year ago, or maybe not even a year ago, when we first heard that Superman, Lois Lane, or Superman, Wonder Woman were going to be an item. To me, that went against the whole iconic concept of Superman, Lois Lane as from really the beginning of the Superman character. But on reflection, it does make sense. I mean, I'm sure that eventually that Superman and Lois Lane will get back together again and so forth. Just like there was Bruce Wayne will eventually become Batman again, Clark Kent will eventually become Superman, and Steve Rogers will eventually become Captain America again every time we have somebody else take over the role. But given their power levels, and the fact that there are things they can discuss that Clark can't really discuss with Lois because of just who they are. Using it at their power level. There was a comic strip, their comic book, years ago, well before New 52. I believe it started out with Superman and Wonder Woman just really going at it, just beating the heck out of each other. And then became obvious they were just practicing. They were just, because they were the only people that could take that type of punishment from the other person. Mm-hmm. It was just fighter practice, pretty much all it was. Mm-hmm. And they were discussing that, how there was just some things that they really can't discuss or really discuss well in a relevant manner with really any of their heroes because they just mm-hmm. lose anybody on their power level.
Right.
So
right.
that does kind of make sense. You stop and you think about it for a while. And I think at this point, now that we've had that concept of Superman, Wonder Woman, and now I think at this point some people may be having a second thoughts about that, saying, wait, well, maybe, maybe.
That's always just going to depend on how it does. You know, does it grab us? Does it draw us in? That's what's going to matter. But given those two folks, I think this will be something definitely worth at least checking out. And so I'm looking forward to that.
If the storyline's good, if it's a solid story, then I think you'll have a chance.
Mm-hmm. I agree with you. Okay, let's run into the previews, and real quickly I'll run down the books that are coming out as of July 3rd, the day before the 4th of July or Independence Day holiday. Mm-hmm. From Boom Studios, book that I'm looking forward to is Deathmatch number 7. That's done by Paul Jenkins and a great little story, kind of a Hunger Games setup that I like real well. And of course, Garfield number 15, which is based on the famous cat in the comic strip. Then from Dark Horse, we get Michael Avon Oeming's The Victories, number 3 of 5. That's the Transhuman storyline, part 3. Pretty good, interesting take on the Justice League, and I like it a lot. And, of course, DC is where I usually get most of my stuff. Action Comics, number 22. Amakami Girls by Palmiotti and Gray, number 5. Batman Incorporated, number 12. Then Batwing, number 22. Batwing showed up in the most recent All-Star Western, which I found an interesting thing. That was pretty good. Then Detective Comics, number 22. Dial H, which is coming to an end, number 14. Earth 2, number 14, which is changing writers. Then Green Arrow from Andrea Sorrentino with the cover. And I didn't know this, but somebody pointed out to me that Andrea is actually a man. I had thought it was that in the States we use that for a female, that that's actually a guy. So I wanted to point that out.
I did not know then, that. I thought that was a girl, too.
I was so convinced it was, but no, apparently that's a guy. So I'm glad to know that.
I wonder if they can intercept those love letters I sent.
Yeah, I think he's going to be a little... He'll be a little unhappy with that, I would imagine. Okay. Green Lantern number 22, which is the new team on there. And Legends of the Dark Knight, which is the redoing or the print version of the Digital First comics, number 10. Movement number 3, the companion piece to the Green Team. Then we've got Stormwatch 22, Swamp Thing number 22, which I mentioned before, being done by Charles Soule. And there's going to be the beginning of the Trinity War, and it's called Trinity of Sin, Pandora number 1. And in conjunction is Trinity of Sin, The Phantom Stranger number 10, which DeMatteis is also working on. We move to Dynamite real quickly. Black Bat number 3, I really like that book. And then speaking of Lone Ranger, his comic, Lone Ranger number 16, appropriately enough, is coming out this week. Also from Dynamite is Mark Waid's Green Hornet number 3, then Miss Fury number 4, and a book I've been looking forward to, a character I remember reading back in the 60s, The Owl number 1 of 4 will be out. From IDW, we move into the trade paperback for Lock and Key Volume 5. Volume 6 is the final one. It's in process right now. From Image, we get Chew number 35, which I like very much. Good big Five Weapons number 5 of 5 is out. Invincible Universe number 4, written by Phil Hester, is a really good book. There's Thief of Thieves, number 15, in the Kirkmanverse. And we quickly go into Marvel. Marvel has, amongst their good stuff, there is Dexter, number 1, based on the Showtime series, which I find interesting that they're turning that into a comic. And then we get the famous Oz books by Eric Schanauer and all. And there's Emerald City of Oz, number 1 of 5. Is that? I got to make sure I get those because I always like those books. And then we go into the Superior Foes of Spider-Man, number 1, which is they're apparently taking everything that's ever been Spider-Man and turning it all into Superior-related stuff. So, and then we get Venom, number 37, which is going on. And that's the end of the books that are coming out this week that it's of interest. Anything else we should talk about before we call it quits?
I'm just wondering if you've heard anything or have any new thoughts concerning digital comics.
Digital comics to me are one of those things that it's going to be probably like CDs. One day you'll wake up and everybody will be reading digital comics, but it hasn't happened yet. Mm-hmm. I find digital comics really helpful. If I'm looking for something that I can't find in paper, then I get to download the digital version of it. You know, I get to go to Comixology or places like that, and then I get to catch up on the story so I can go back to reading the paper. I don't think I've made the transition completely to digital. I don't think many people have. But you never know. One day I think it's probably going to happen. That's going to be the end of comic stores as we know them.
Yeah, I hate that idea, but I think that's going to happen somewhere down the road.
And on that note, we'll call it quits for this week's news and previews. Thanks, Steve, for talking with me, and we'll talk with you again sometime in the future.
All right.
And that's a wrap for this episode. Until next time, keep reading your comics.
Hal Jordan of Earth, Green Lantern of Sector 2814. The Viceroy of Demrak 7 claims that when we assigned you to police crucial peace negotiations, you punched him in the face. Is this true?
No, sir. I punched the Viceroy in the stomach. Then I headbutted him in the face. Sir.